And so we open Sefer Bamidbar. And Bamidbar opens, as it means to continue, with counting. It is the beginning of Numbers, of Chumash HaPekudim. And Rashi gives us something of an orientation towards the idea of HaKadosh Baruch Hu counting Bnei Yisrael. Of course, we appreciate that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will not count for the reason that a person would count, namely in order to know, because he knows. And Rashi comments, Mitoch chibosam lefanav, it is through HaKadosh Baruch Hu's love for Bnei Yisrael, Mona osam kol sha'a, he counts them constantly. How so? Rashi details for us. Kishayotu mimitzrayim mina'on. When we left Mitzrayim, HaKadosh Baruch Hu counted us. That is a reference to the pasuk in Parshas Bo, where there is no census, but the pasuk does state how many of the Bnei Yisrael left. Kishesh mios elef ragli levad mita. Ukeshenaflu be'egel. And when Bnei Yisrael fell, or some of them fell at the time of the Egel, mina'on, they were counted again. That's, of course, the counting in Parshas Kisisa. Leda minyan hanusarim, to know who was left. And finally, ukesheba lahashros shchinoso aleihem, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu comes to have his divine presence dwell amongst Bnei Yisrael, mina'om, he counts them, hence the counting at the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar. Rashi calls this kol sha'a. He's given us three occasions and explained that the theme that is behind the counting is mitoch chibason shel Yisrael, the love that HaKadosh Baruch Hu holds for us, the Bnei Yisrael. And Mefarshei Rashi raise one or two questions. Firstly, it's interesting to note that Rashi has stated for us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has counted the Bnei Yisrael twice already, once when they left Mitzrayim, once in Parshas Kisisa, and this is the third time. But it's interesting that Rashi has never spoken about this prior to this third occasion. In Parshas Bo, Rashi says nothing. In Parshas Kisisa, no comment. And in Parshas Bamidbar, Rashi comes to explain what the idea of counting is about. And our question, of course, is, well, the idea, presumably, has always been the same. Why did Rashi not feel the need to discuss it until this third counting? One may say, as a counterpoint, that perhaps it's not really a Rashi topic at all. When we remember that Rashi's job description is liyashev pshuto shel mikra, to explain the simple meaning of the psukim, to discuss the concept of HaKadosh Baruch Hu counting Bnei Yisrael, one could argue, is beyond the realms of understanding pshuto shel mikra. Whatever the pasuk means, that's what it means, regardless of the concept behind it. One could say, it's not really something that Rashi would get involved in. That said, the question will then simply reverse. So why does Rashi get involved in it at all? And therefore, to sum up this first question, if there are three occasions, why did Rashi delay comment on the first two and only engage in counting number three? The second question, which is actually more of a Rashi question, is that the words that we just quoted from Rashi, mitoch chibason, mona osam kol sha'a, those are Rashi's comments on Dibur HaMaschil Vayidaber B'Midbar Sinai Be'echad LaChodesh. That is to say, Rashi is making this comment in Bamidbar Perek Aleph, Pasuk Aleph. The very first Pasuk. And the reason why that is noteworthy is because Pasuk Aleph hasn't yet said anything. Pasuk Aleph is setting time and place. Bamidbar Sinai, Bashana Hashenis. It is Pasuk Beis that will actually introduce the command to count Bnei Yisrael. Pasuk Beis reads, as we know, Se'u,
Es rosh kaladas b'nei Yisrael, lemishbachosam, lebeisavosam, count b'nei Yisrael, etc.
So this is very interesting, because Rashi's comment isn't really addressing anything in Pasuk Aleph, because Pasuk Aleph hasn't yet spoken about the count. Rashi's remarks would better have been placed on Pasuk Beis, which says, Su'u, es rosh kaladas b'nei Yisrael. The Pasuk says to count, and Rashi will explain, for whatever reason, why is Hashem counting them?
So, especially when you put these two questions together, because Rashi's held his peace for three entire chumashim. But when he comes to talk about it, it sounds like he can't even wait for the right pasuk. Because pasuk Aleph and Rashi's already writing. And all of this needs to be understood very well to appreciate what exactly Rashi means to say. And as is often the case, the answer to this Rashi will actually be found in another Rashi. And we are alerted to this by the Bartanura. The Bartanura, of course, as we know, Rabbeinu Avadimi Bartanura is famous for his commentary on the Mishnayos. He is practically the Rashi of the Mishnah. But he also had a short commentary on Rashi. And in the course of that commentary, he directs our attention to later on in Chumash Bamidbar, to Parshas Baalosecha, Perek Tes, Pasuk Aleph. And the beginning of Perek Tes is about Korban Pesach, as we know, the famous episode. There were people, Hayu Tameim, the Nefesh Adam, they couldn't bring the Pesach Rishon, and thus we were introduced to Pesach Sheni. The Torah introduces that section in the following way, Perek Tes, Pasuk Aleph. Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe b'midbar Sinai, Bashona Hashenis, Letzeisa me'eretz Mitzrayim, so this is in the second year of Bnei Yisrael leaving Mitzrayim, B'chodesh HaRishon Leimor, in the first month. The first month, of course, as far as the reckoning of the Torah is concerned, is Nisan. And therefore, the Pasuk is telling us that this message was given at the beginning of Chodesh Nisan of the second year. And that's very interesting because that actually identifies this section of the Chumash as the very first event in Chumash Bamidbar. Rashi comments, Parsha Shebarosh HaSefer Lo Nemra Ad Iyar. The parsha at the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar was not said until Iyar. That's actually explicit in the Pasuk. It's the beginning of the second month. The counting started in the beginning of Iyar. And then this later chapter is, of course, in Chodesh Nisan. Lamadata She'ein Seide Muktam Umu'ucha Batorah. So this is a classic example. It's unavoidable that the Torah has not presented things in their chronological order. The first matter to be discussed happened in Chodesh Iyar, in the second month. A later episode was happened at the beginning of Nisan, which is the first month, that's earlier. Ein muktamu mu'ucha batorah. Now what's very interesting is, this is not the first time that Rashi has introduced us to the concept of ein muktamu mu'ucha batorah. He's done it a few times. But what is unusual about this case is Rashi having identified that the Seder is not kept chronologically, will now proceed to wonder why. Why did the Torah not put the earlier event first? Wouldn't that make more sense? It's very interesting that Rashi would do that. In most other cases, Rashi is content. His job is done, as he identifies for us, that the order is not preserved. Why? I don't know. Or if Rashi knows, he's not telling, because it's no longer germane to his job as the Mefarish Pshuto Shel Mikra. On this occasion, Rashi says, the order hasn't been preserved, and why not? Why does Rashi ask why only on this occasion? I think the answer is very simple. This case of Ein Muktam Umu'ucha Batorah is not like the other cases. In the other cases, Rashi has to work it out for us that the order has not been preserved. You need Rashi to observe it and to deduce it for you. Because the Pasuk doesn't announce that the later event happened first. If you know the content of the parshas, you'll work it out. And if you don't, Rashi will work it out for you. On this occasion, the Torah doesn't leave it to you to work it out.
The Torah places timestamps on both of these parshas. The Torah tells you that the opening parsha happened in the second month. And the Torah tells you that the later parsha happened in the first month. That means that it is being advertised and publicized that the order has been reversed. And if that's the case, then the Torah wants you to know it and is telling you for a reason. And if that's true, then part of responding to what the Torah is saying is to wonder, and what would that reason be? And thus Rashi embarks on the second wave question of why was the order not preserved? And his answer, as is well known, is this section of Korban Pesach could not open the Chumash. The reason why, Mipnei Uvelama lo Pasach Bazo, why did the Chumash Bamidbar not open with this earliest of episodes? Mipnei Shehu Gnusan Shel Yisrael, because it reflects badly on the Bnei Yisrael. Why? Shekol Abar Im Shana, Shehayu Yisrael Bamidbar, Lo Hikrivu Ela Pesach Zebulvat, because this was the only Korban Pesach brought in the entire 40 years. They didn't bring another Korban Pesach. The next 39 years, there's nothing. And that's Gnusan Shel Yisrael. Now, of course, as Mefarshim point out, some Mefarshi Rashi point out, there is no Korban of Pesach in Chutz La'aretz. This was the only one. So it's the exception. The next 39 years, they had no mitzvah of Korban Pesach. But says Maharal, that's the Gnus, because we should have been in Israel by this time next year. And therefore, the 39 years where you don't have the mitzvah of Korban Pesach, that itself is the question. Well, why don't you have the mitzvah of Korban Pesach? That's Gnusan Shel Yisrael. Now, what's of course imperative to point out is that as much as there's an aspect of Gnusan Shel Yisrael, there's a negative reflection on the Jewish people, that doesn't mean the Torah doesn't talk about it at all. If the Torah never spoke about things that reflected negatively about the Jewish people, so there would be no reference to the Chet HaEgel or to the Chet HaMeraglim, and worse, we would have no way of being beware of any of those mistakes not to repeat them. There are reasons why the Torah needs to speak about things. If something negative happened, you need to learn from it. That's the way to learn those parshas. But if that's true, there now is the question, not should this be discussed, it needs to be discussed. But timing is everything. Does it need to be spoken about? Ultimately, yes. But now the question is, how do you open a sefer? How do you start? Do you start with something negative? No. And therefore, Rashi is saying this parsha is neatly tucked away into Parshas Balosecha, where you haven't begun with a negative atmosphere. Adkan from Rashi in Parshas Balosecha. And now the Bartanura adds a wonderful conclusion. Why did Bamidbar start with the topic that it started with? We would no longer have the intuitive answer, namely, well, presumably this happened first, because we know that's not true. We know that the first episode, the earliest episode, is actually recorded later in Bamidbar. So if that's moved away from opening the Sefer, then what will be chosen to open the Sefer? The answer, says Bartanura, is very simple. If the earliest episode was moved away because it reflects badly on Yisrael, and you don't wish to open a Sefer that way, so you're not going to preserve chronology anymore, so on what basis will the opening parsha be chosen? The answer is the opening parsha will supplement what the earliest parsha didn't have. Namely, the earliest parsha will be chosen because it reflects positively on Bnei Yisrael. That's what it has going for it. That's what allows it, gives it pride of place to open the parsha. That's why the earliest parsha couldn't do that. And therefore, says Bartanura, if you understand why Rosh Chodesh Nisan could not open because it's Gnusan Shel Yisrael, then whatever you do find will be Chibosan Shel Yisrael. And that is why Rashi, for the first and last time, discusses the idea of what the counting is about. It's about Chibosan Shel Yisrael. And our question was, is Rashi getting involved in philosophy? He never did this before, not in Parshas Bo, not in Parshas Kisisa. Quite true, because on those occasions, there was nothing to discuss in terms of the pshat of the pasuk. Rashi gets involved in this question in Parshas Bamidbar because it relates to the pasuk itself. Namely, why is this, which is clearly a later event, why does it open the Chumash? That's a good shaila, and it's a pshat shaila. And the answer is, mitochi bosan shel Yisrael. And that explains to us, says Bar Tanura, why Rashi's comment is to be found not on Pasuk Beis, which is the mitzvah of counting, but in Pasuk Aleph, which gives us time and date. Because it's actually the date in the Pasuk Aleph that Rashi is responding to. The fact that the Torah goes out of its way to say this happened later, it wants you to take notice of that and realize that it's a later event and ponder why it is that, if that's the case, then it opens the Chumash. And Rashi says, Mitochi Bosan Shel Yisrael. And that's why the correct location, if we understand the background to Rashi's comment, is on Pasuk Aleph before there's even been any mention of the counting, because it's addressing the time as found in Pasuk Aleph. So this is a wonderful interpretation of Rashi, and there are others, but this is a classic from the Bar Tanura. It's very interesting, while we are on this topic, to point out, as was pointed out by Reb Leib Hyman Zatzal, that the truth of the matter is that Chumash Bamidbar now takes its place in the way that it opens alongside all of the five Chumashim. The concept of opening in positively, and not only positively in an abstract way, but in a way that reflects positively on Bnei Yisrael, is actually true for all of the five Chumashim. If you consult the first Rashi in each of the Chumashim, that is what you will find, an aspect of Chiba. The first Rashi in Bereishis, or more accurately, the Rashi that comments on the beginning of Bereishis, which of course grammatically is difficult because Bereishis is a construct form, it means in the beginning of, and there is no of. Rashi says, Ein ha-mikra hazeh omer ela darsheni. One needs to approach this word through the lens of drash, Bereishis, bishvil ha-Torah shenikres Bereishis, u bishvil Yisrael shenikru Bereishis. Kodesh Yisrael Lashem, Bereishis tevuaso. The very first word of the Torah, as far as Rashi is concerned, is telling you that the entire world is created for Bnei Yisrael and the Torah. Etzchi bosan shel Yisrael. What about the beginning of Shemos? Well, it begins, of course, Ve'ele Shemos Bnei Yisrael, Habo'i Mitzrayma. Is there anything unusual about that opening? Says Rashi, yes, we actually know everyone who came down to Mitzrayim. They've been mentioned by name in the end of Chumash Bereishis, in Parshas Vayigash. Rashi comments, Afapi Shemina'an Bechayehem Bishmosam, even though they've already been mentioned while they were yet alive, coming down to Mitzrayim, Chozar Umena'an Bimisosam, they are mentioned again after they passed away in the beginning of Shemos, Lehodia Chibosam, to teach you how beloved they are, Shenim Shelula Kochavim, each one has their name, and their names will endure. And therefore, Chumash, Shemos, as does Bereishis, opens with Chibosan in this instance of the Shvatim, which are the pillars of Yisrael. Then, the beginning of Vayikra, which begins, Vayikra el Moshe, Hashem called Moshe. Of course, Rashi says from a certain point of view that's redundant. The pasuk goes on to say Hashem spoke to him. If he spoke to him, then either he called him or he didn't call him. But that means that he called him before he spoke to him. It says Rashi, L'chol dibros, u'l'chol amiros, u'l'chol tzivuyim, prior to every single message and command that is given to Moshe, kodma kriya, first he called him. It says Rashi, Loshon chiba, it's a term of endearment. HaKadosh Baruch Hu first calls him to Moshe and then speaks to him. And therefore, Vayikra el Moshe begins with Lashon Chiba. Chumash Bamidbar, which we are discussing now, as we mentioned, opens with the count because it's Chibosan Shel Yisrael. And what about Chumash Devarim? Chumash Devarim opens with a list of places. Eila HaDvarim, Asher Diber Moshe, Bnei Yisrael, Bamidbar, Barava, Mosuf, Ben Paran, Netofa, Velavan, Chatzeres, Medizahav, it's names. But Rashi says, these are not just names of places. These are names of references to incidents that happened in those places. Negative incidents, actually. All the places that Bnei Yisrael made mistakes. Lefi shein divrei tochochos. There is an aspect of rebuke in these words. Umana kan kol ha-makom ha-shech isu lefnei ha-makom behen. Moshe mentions places that Bnei Yisrael angered HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lefi chach sosem es hadvarim. And that's why Moshe, as he opens the Sefer, does not engage in explicit head-on rebuke, but rather he ellipses the places or the episodes. V'yizkirin baremes, and he just mentions the places. V'hamevin yovin, says Rashi, mipnei kvodon shel Yisrael, out of respect for Yisrael. So it's very interesting. Eila dvarim is really Asher dibe Moshe, but Moshe opens Mishum kvodom shel Yisrael, just like the first four chumashim opened Mishum chiba of Yisrael, of the Shvatim, of Moshe himself. And this then is the tone that is set to all of the chumashim. And once again, as Maral points out, in Sefer Devarim, it's not as if Moshe will not come in the fullness of time to discuss in blow-by-blow detail all of the difficult episodes. Meraglim and Egel. He will. Within 22 psukim, we're already in the Meraglim, piece by piece. But that's not how you open. The way one opens a parsha is in a positive way, because that, in a sense, that sets the tone. Mistakes can be born if the tone that is set is positive, because the moral of the story is one can do better. If one opens in the negative, the implication seems to be there's no hope, really, and that's not Torah at all. So these are important comments with regards to the opening of all of the Chumashim, and specifically as we've come to appreciate the opening of Chumash Bamidbar. Now, further within the comments of Rashi, I'd like to refer to one of the more obscure comments here, which is again to be found in Bamidbar Perek Aleph. Bnei Yisrael are counted, and to assist Moshe to play some form of role in the counting are the Nesiim. And Pasuk states, Perek Aleph Pasuk Yud Zayin, having mentioned all the names, there's 12 psukim of names, Lemate Reuven, Lemate Shimon, as we know. That's really Pasuk Hey until Pasuk Tesvav. And then, Pasuk Yud Zayin states, Vayikach Moshe Va'aharon, Eso Anoshim Ha'ele, Asher Nikvu B'Shemus. So Moshe and Aaron, they took these men, who were mentioned explicitly by name. Now, the pasuk itself needs to be understood, because we just had 12 psukim where they're mentioned by name. So had the pasuk said, "Vayikach Moshe va'Aaron es ha'anoshim ha'ele," they took these men, we know who these men are. These are the men that have just been mentioned. But the pasuk says, Moshe and Aaron took these men, who have just been mentioned explicitly by name. We should have noticed that they were mentioned explicitly by name. So what does this extra phrase come to add? Which is a good shaila. Rashi comments on the words asher nikvu, no cave, which are mentioned explicitly. Rashi says, asher nikvu lo kan b'shemos. They were mentioned here by name. And this is now even more mystifying, because if I thought I already knew what the pasuk is saying, I certainly think I already know what Rashi is saying. I know that they've been mentioned by name. What does the pasuk need to tell me? And I know that they're mentioned here by name. So what does Rashi mean to add? He's clearly responding to these extra words in the pasuk, but he just seems to have dug the question deeper, because everything that's being said, I know. There is no commentary here. They've been mentioned here, I know that. And they've been mentioned here, I know that. Says the Or Yashar, to understand, and it's a little bit enigmatic, and I think as well, it's Kvodom Shel Yisrael. Rashi, in a very delicate way, is alerting us to something that we will find later on. The beginning of Parshas Korach. So who was with Korach? Some of them we know are mentioned in the Pasuk by name, Dasan and Aviram, Ohn ben Peles for a little while, And then there were 250 men, and we don't know who they are. They're just 250 men. There must be something about them, but they're not mentioned by name. Says Rashi, we know who 12 of them are. And the reason why is because, as Rashi says, Ruban Mishevet Reuven, most of them are from Reuven, who were somewhat disgruntled, having been pushed aside from the Bechorah, and they're the neighbors of Korach also. Behem Elitzur ben Shideur v'chaveirav v'chayotze bo. This is very, very sad. 12 of the 250 men who met their end in the episode of Korach were the 12 Nesiim. Elitzur ben Shideur. And Nesanel ben Suar. And Nachshon ben Aminodov. And all of those. How do we know? Says Rashi, Shene'emar. You see, the Pasuk doesn't mention them by name in Korach, but it gives us defining characteristics. It calls them Kiriyei Eda. Right? Nesiei Eda. Kiriyei Moed. There's only a few people that answer to that description. And says Rashi, Ulahalan, elsewhere it says, Eile Kiruei Ha'eda. That is a reference to the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar. The 12 Nesiim are mentioned, and they're referred to as Kiruei Ha'eda. And now they are called, in this parsha, Nesiei Eda, Kiriyei Moed. And in fact, Rashi sources the Medrash, and the Medrash says that it gives a mashal of someone that people close to him had soured. He didn't want to expose them so publicly, but of course you need to know who they are. Because once again, we need to learn from it. But if you can give enough defining characteristics, you'll know who they are. If you say Nesiei Eda, if you say Kiriyei Moed, we get the picture. We know who they are. And once again, Kvodom Shel Yisrael. It's Kvodom Shel Nesiim, when you think about it, because where does someone's name feature in the Torah? That wherever his name is, that's where he is really. Now, he may make a mistake, but you see, the Torah never calls them by name. They pay the price for throwing their lot in with Korach, but that's not their name. Their name is when they are at their best, at their finest hour, in the beginning of Chumash Bamidbar. And this, says Rashi, we've already been alerted to the fact that these Nesiim, if we see the subtlety of what's happening here, these 12 Nesiim, they will not be mentioned by name at the time, at that critical time. They're mentioned here. That's why the Pasuk stresses the fact that they're mentioned here. We know they've been mentioned here, because they've just been mentioned here. But when the Pasuk stresses the fact that they've asher nikvu, they've been mentioned here, what it means to say is, there'll be another place where you will not find them mentioned, but they're still there. But they will not be explicit. Here it's explicit. Asher nikvu b'shemos. Elsewhere it won't be so explicit. And Rashi, drawing out the concept of what the Torah is saying, adds the word asher nikvu kan. As if to say, that's what the Pasuk is stressing. Here they have been mentioned. Elsewhere they won't be mentioned. Mishum kavodam. So there's a great deal within these very terse psukim, which seem to be describing details, but the Torah is setting really lessons for us. Where do you mention a person's name? Where is that person's essence? And where do you need to know? But it's enough to identify them through their characteristics. And what's fascinating is, may inyan le'inyan, but also inyan. There is another place in Chumash Bamidbar where we will already be primed for the setting of the episode of Korach. And that is, if we take a look in Perek Gimel, Pasuk Kaf Vav. Pardon me, Pasuk Kaf Tes. Perek Gimel, Pasuk Kaf Tes. Now here, the families of Kehos are being, of Levi, are being counted and described as to where they were around the Mishkan. So there's three families of Levi, Gershon, Kehos, Umarari. And in Pasuk Kaftes, it states, Mishpachos b'nei Kehos yachanu, al yerach ha-Mishkan, teimana. So Kehas, of the three, they encamp to the south of the Mishkan, Teimana. The south is always called Teiman from the word Yemin. A person is always in the Torah considered to be facing east, whereby the south is to the right and the north is to the left. Rashi comments, the family of Kehas are to the south. Do you know who else is in the south? Meaning outside of that inner circle of Machane Levia is Machane Yisrael. There's three tribes also on the south side. And one of those tribes is Reuven. Usmuchin lahem degel Reuven. The flag of Reuven is there, the camp of Reuven. Hachonim Teimana, says Rashi, Oila Rosha, Oila Shcheino. Woe to the Rosha, woe to his neighbor. Lachach loku mehem dosan vavirim, umasai mechamishim ish im korach va'adoso. You see, 250 men, most of whom came from Reuven, came to a bad end because they lived in a bad neighborhood or they had bad neighbors. Now, this Rashi is astounding. I think we know it very well. But it's always astonishing that here and in Parshas Korach, Dasan and Aviram, from a certain point of view, are looked upon as the neighbors of the Rasha. I don't know that we would have looked upon it that way. Dasan and Aviram, for us, they can create their own neighborhood of Rishoyim. To say about Dasan and Aviram, you know, they fell into bad company, what can you do? They never had a chance. I mean, Dasan and Aviram, they'd be causing trouble from day one. It's fascinating that there remains a certain catalyst that brought out the worst in them through Korach. Ad kedei kach. Korach does not escape being implemented as being a bad influence on Dasan and Aviram. I mean, that takes some saying. Now, what's amazing is, again, there will always be two questions when we see a Rashi. Number one, what is the meaning of what you know, Rashi intends to say? And number two, why is Rashi commenting? As if to say, bear in mind that the placing of the families of Levi around the Mishkan, it's true for all three of them. I mean, Parshas Bamidbar, it tells you where Gershon was, it tells you where Merari was, and it tells you where Kehas was, which means that it doesn't sound like there is anything amiss. It doesn't sound like there's any reason for us to take particular note of the fact that Kehas was in the south and so was Reuven. The Torah has to tell me where they are. Does it want me to come to this conclusion? Oy l'rosh, oy l'shcheinu? So forth. It sounds like information. Later on in Parshas Korach, it's unavoidable and I'll draw my conclusions. But what is it about the Pasuk that Rashi already sees a certain signal here? The Pasuk is saying, look at B'nai Kehas. They're in the south and so is Reuven and there's trouble brewing. Where do I see trouble? So Rav Hyman says, again, classic comment, I saw the roots of it in the Maskil Adavid as well, is that if we read the Psukim as carefully as Rashi did, we may get a sense of why he commented here. There are three sons of Levi, Gershon, Kehas, and Merari, and they are mentioned in Psukim Kaf Gimel, Kaf Tes, and Lamed He, respectively. And let us take a look at the Pasuk that came before and after, and maybe we'll see why Rashi commented here. Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Mishpachos HaGershuni. Gershon is the oldest, and he's mentioned first. And Mishpachos HaGershuni, Acharei HaMishkan Yachanu Yama. They encamp behind, so to speak, the Mishkan, Yama, to the west. Okay. Let's move ahead to Pasuk Lamed Hei. Unesibes of the Mishpachos Merari Tzuria ben Avichael al Yerech HaMishkan Yechanu Tzafona. They encamp to the north. So to the east actually is Moshe and Aaron themselves, which means that the other three directions, north, west, and south, are the three families of Levi. Says Rav Hyman, if we pay careful attention, we will see that the way that the family of Kehas and their encamping has been described, slightly different, significantly different though, than the other two. Namely, if we have them all three in front of us at the same time, in a sweep, Pasuk Kaf Gimel says, Yachanu Yama. And the final Pasuk Lamed Hei says, Yachanu Tzafona. And that means they encamp to the north and they encamp to the south, and that's that. Pasuk Kaftes, which is the Pasuk of Kahas, says, Mishpachos b'nei Kahas yachanu al yerach ha-mishkan teimana. There to the south. The most significant aspect of this Pasuk is that the word yachanu is accompanied by an esnachta. Underneath the word yachanu is an esnachta of the Talmi HaMikra. And an esnachta, as we know, is a pause. The way the Pasuk is read is Mishpachos b'nei Kahas yachanu, pause, Ayerach HaMishkan Teimana, on the south side. Now that's different than the other two families. With the other two families, it's one phrase, Yachanu Tzafona, Yachanu Yama, because you need the direction in order to qualify where they were camped. It is naturally one phrase. What does the Torah therefore mean by taking the natural phrase of Yachanu Teimana and splitting it up and making me pause on Yachanu, where I don't even know where they are, and then, in a separate phrase, have the fact that they're Teimana? What does that mean? Says Rav Hyman, what it means is the Torah wants you to pause at Yachanu. Because in giving the direction of Teimana a phrase all unto its own, it is laying emphasis on that direction that you never had with the other families. With the other families, he's in the north, he's in the west, and when it comes to Kahas, the musical intonation of the Pasuk is, B'nei Kahas, they encamped. Pause. And you know where? On the south. Meaning there's something significant about them being on the south side that we never really had that significance with the north and with the west. And that's why Rashi says the Pasuk is already alerting you that it's emphasizing the fact they're on the south, because you know who else is on the south? Dosan and Aviram, Oyla Rasha, Oyla Shechena. So these are really illuminating for us examples of how Rashi is hopefully teaching us to approach the psukim with sensitivity and get an appreciation of why Rashi says the things that he does. Now, I'd like to move from here later in the parsha, Perek Dalet Pasuk Vav. There's many numbers in the parsha, as we know. But Perek Dalet actually describes the way that the Mishkan would travel. And they would dismantle the kelim, and they would wrap them up, and then they would be taken. And let's come to consider the Aron, which is already described in Pasuk Hey. Uvo Aron uvonav ben soah hamachane, Perek Dalet Pasuk Hey. Aron and his sons, they would come, as the machane is about to travel. V'haridu es parochas hamasach, they would take down the paroches, v'chisu bo es aron ha'edus, and they would use the paroches to cover over the Aron. People couldn't see it when it's in transit, when the Mishkan is being dismantled. V'nasnu alav kisui or tachash, and they would put also another covering of the skin of the tachash. Uparsu beged kalil techeles milamala, and then a further covering of techeles. V'samu badav, and they would insert the poles. Now, what's interesting about this pasuk is if we go back to Parshas Truma, when the Torah describes how the Kelim and the Mishkan were to be constructed, it states, you've got the Aron, you've got the Taba'os, and then it says, B'taba'os ha'aron yihiyu habadim, in the rings of the Aron, that's where the poles should be, lo yosuru mimenu, they shall not be removed from those rings. Now, and whereas perhaps the pashtus of the pasuk means lo yasuru just means that they'll stay there, it actually happens to be an issur Torah to remove them. The Gemara says in Maseches Yuma daf Ayin Beis, lo yasuru mimenu means it is forbidden to remove them. And all of this leads us to a very simple question, which is raised by the Tosus in Yuma there, daf Ayin Beis. Namely, if it's true that the poles of the Aron are not allowed to be removed, so why does the Pasuk say that as preparation for journeying, they would wrap up the Aron and they would insert the poles? The poles had never been uninserted. The poles had never been removed. They're not allowed to be removed. They're always there. So what then is the meaning of the words, V'samu badav? How can you put something once it's already there? Which is a good shaila. And the Tosfos have three responses to this question. Each one a chiddush, in a sense, in its own way. Of course, one has to say something, because things being as they are, we have a problem. The first explanation, the Tosfos quotes in one of the names of the great Baal HaTosfos, Rabbeinu Yaakov Meorleans. And Rabbeinu Yaakov says, chiddush in parshanut, that when the Torah, it's true, the poles were always there. When the Torah says, as a prelude to traveling, v'samu badav, they place the poles, it is not a reference of placing the poles, inserting them into the rings, because they're always there, but rather, v'samu badav, they place the poles on the shoulders of the Levim. V'samu badav, to place, is not that they are the entity that's being placed and now they are in place, but rather they're being placed on the shoulders of the Levim. That's Basamu Badav. Interestingly, it was pointed out by, much later on, Rav Eliezer Moshe Hurwitz, that's how the Abbezin of Pinsk, that if you look at the other Kalim, where it also talks about, uses a similar expression about putting the poles in, the menorah, and the Mizbech HaKetores, and the Shulchan, there it says, V'samu es badav. And with the Aron, it did not say V'samu es badav. It said V'samu badav. What's the difference between V'samu es badav? The word es is one of the most elusive words in the Hebrew language. It defies translation, that's for sure. It obviously will always mean something. But the difference is, in this instance, says Eliezer Moshe, that V'samu es badav means that is the entity that's being discussed. It is now being placed within the, where it needs to be placed, within the rings. When it comes to the Aron, it's already there. So V'samu Vadav, there's a subtext, V'samu Vadav, on the shoulders of B'nai Kehos. That's why it's V'samu Vadav and not V'samu Es Vadav. That's a very delicate diktuk lashon. So this is the approach of Rabbeinu Yaakov Meorleans. The poles were always there. There is no inserting of the poles. They never left. V'samu Badav refers unusually, in this instance, to placing the poles on the shoulders of the Levim. Tosfos themselves present another explanation, and that is, as true as it is, that the poles never left the Aron, lo yasur mimenu, however, normally, when the Mishkan was standing, we know from the Talmud elsewhere in Maseches Yoma and Nundalid that the poles were not centered. That is to say, if the poles are 10 amos long, there was not 5 amos on each side. But rather, as the Aron stood, where it stood in the Kodesh HaKadoshim, the poles were actually drawn eastwards, as the Gemara tells us, and they protruded into the Paroches and pushed it out an amma. And there's a very fascinating thesis of the Netziv, who states that it's that amma that Moshe stood in to receive the Torah, which was part Kodesh and part Kodesh HaKadoshim. It's behind the Paroches, but it's a zone that's been made available by the Badim pushed out, an amma. That's his explanation. The Talmud says explicitly they pushed out an amma, and that means that they were not centered. Says the Tosfos, as long as the Mishkan is at rest, that's fine. But as they come to travel, so then the aura needs to be centered, so there shouldn't be any type of imbalance. And thus he says, the poles never left the rings. But still the Pasuk says, V'samu Badav, because V'samu Badav means they need to be placed exactly in the way that is correct for travel, namely equidistant on each side. And it's interesting that certainly in other settings we find that the expression of Sima always has a connotation of exactitude, as opposed to nesina. Nesina can be more broad. But when it comes to sima, very often it has that aspect of getting things exactly right. The classic example is pointed out by the Torah Tamima in the Sefer Tosefes Brachah and Parshas Vayera, when Avram sends Hagar away, so it says that he took food and bread and water, vayikach lechem, vechemas mayim, vayitein el Hagar, Sam al Shechma.
So it actually has both expressions. Nesina, he gave them to Hagar. Salma Shechma, he placed them on her shoulder. Hagar is a person, that's a general setting. Specifically on her shoulder. So Vayitain El Hagar, to the person was Nesina, but to specifically where, that's Sam Al Shechma. And therefore we have this aspect of finding down the specifics and precision, that's called Sima Vesamu Bada. The final approach of Tosfos in Yuma there, is, which is actually quite a chiddush, especially if you've never heard it, as is often the case with chiddushim. The Torah states in Chumash Shemos, Truma, Perek Kafhei, Pasuk Yud Beis. It's about the Aron. If we read the pasuk, you'll see straight away what the issue is. V'yatzaktalo. This is talking about the Aron, and there should be welded onto it. Arba taba'os zahav. Four rings of gold. V'nosata al arba pa'amosav. On the four corners. So there's two really on each side. Then the pasuk says, Ushtei taba'os al tzaloha echas. Ushtei taba'os al tzaloha shenis. If we translate literally, and two rings on the one side, and two rings on the other side. So now the question is, we're just reading, how many rings are there on the Aron? And why? Well, Rashi comments, straight away, when the Pasuk says, the second half of the Pasuk, Ushtei taba'os, and two on the one side, and two on the other side, says Rashi, be aware. Hein, hein, dalet taba'os, shebetchilas hamikra. These two sets of rings that are being described, they are the four rings that have been described in the beginning of the pasuk. It's just the pasuk didn't tell us exactly where they were. It just says four and four corners. We didn't know that they had a grouping of two per side. Uperish lecha heichan hayu. And the Torah tells you where. And Rashi says, even though it's introduced with a vav, the second half of the pasuk, which really sounds that they are an additional four rings, they're not. And the vav doesn't mean that. Sometimes the vav doesn't mean and. That's Rashi's comment. And I think it's correct to say that the notion, the commonly held notion, if we picture the Aron, is that there's four rings in it. And that's really Rashi. However, the Ibn Ezra, at least in one place, and the Tosfos here, are of the opinion that the second half of the pasuk there is describing an additional set of four rings. And the point is that the pasuk now has eight rings, four sets of two, because there are actually two sets of two badim. One for travel, and one that never leave. That is to say, whatever the message, and there are many explanations and interpretations as to why it is that the poles never leave the Aron, those are not the poles that are carried when it's travel, when the Aron is traveling. There is a separate set, and to that end there is a separate, not an additional set of four rings. And when the Aron comes to travel, that, to that end, the Torah says in Parshas Bamidbar, Vesamu Badav, the traveling poles, they are actually only inserted when it's to travel. And then when it travels, there are four poles. But when it's at rest, those poles are removed, and there is a set that never leaves, Lo Yasuru Mimenu. So that's quite a different approach. Again, each one in the way that they look at the Pasuk, and it all begins from considering the pasuk of Vesamu Badav in light of Parshas Truma, which says that the poles never leave the Aron, Lo Yasuru Mimenu. These are the classic three responses of Tosfos to that pasuk. Now I'd like to conclude by referring to Perek Dalet generally. For Perek Dalet, it talks about the count of Bnei Kehos and their jobs. Okay, as we mentioned before, Kehos were one of three families of Levi. And they're counted here. Gershon and Merari, the other two brothers, are also counted. They are counted, and their avoda is described in the beginning of next week's Parsha. The beginning of Noso. That's how Noso begins. Noso es Rosh B'nei Gershon Gamhein. And after then, B'nei Merari. And the Abarbanel asks a simple question.
Why does the Torah interrupt what is essentially one idea, namely the relative numbers and jobs of the three sons of Levi, and split it up into two parshas? The Arba Banel understands that these parshas, the chalukah of the parshas, goes back to antiquity. So why is the one idea split up, and the first of the brothers is to be in one parsha, and the second and the third are in another parsha? It's the middle of an inyan. Doesn't seem to be a natural divide. And the Arba Banel doesn't say this, but I think we all understand that the answer cannot be in order to make Parshas Noso even longer. I think there's many a bar mitzvah boy who wouldn't have minded if Gershon and Merari would also be at the end of Bamidbar. And the answer of the Arba Banel is stunning. Kehos is the first of the brothers to be counted. He's not the oldest, but that we know. He's the middle brother. Gershon, Kehos, Umerari. Now, we would understand that the brothers should be counted in order of age. It's not the case. And the reason why, says the Arba Banel, is very simple. Because Kehos have an elevated status, because they are the ones who carry the Aron and the Kalim of the Mishkan. Now, it's interesting to ponder in a meta sense, well, if they're not the oldest, then why are they getting the most choshev a job? Which is another question. But the fact remains that they are the ones who engage in the epicenter of the Mishkan. They're the ones who carry the Kalim themselves. The other brothers, they will carry the beams. It's all part of the Mishkan, but we understand the Aron is the jewel in the crown. And that's why, in spite of the fact that they're not the oldest, they are counted first. It's an issue of Kovod HaTorah. Plain and simple, Kovod HaTorah is a very important Torah ideal. So they're counted first. However, says Arba Banel, that's not where the matter lies. That's not the end of the story. Because the question is, well, what about Gershon? And what's behind the question is, well, Gershon's the oldest. And the oldest is a Bechor, and that's also a Torah value. I mean, the Bechor also has some sort of elevated status. You could say it's not as elevated as the one that carries a Torah. Okay. But now the question is, so what about the Bechor? What about Gershon? He's the oldest. What do we say? He's not first. There's no way. You can't both be first. Only one can be first, and it's Kehos. But what does that mean for Gershon? Do we say, we're very sorry, we know the oldest, but too bad, because you're not carrying the Aron, so just stand in line with everybody else. Says the Arba Banel, no. The Torah says, listen, they can't both be first. But he is the Bechor. He's not going to be first. But is there any way that can be recognized? Is there any way that he can get covered that is due to him? The answer is yes. The Parsha ends with Kehos, and Gershon begins a Parsha, because he's a Bechor. Amazing comment of the Arba Banel. Somewhat atypical, one may say. But I think the message of the Arba Banel is so profound. Because really what he's saying is that in a hierarchy of values, one has to have a very keen sense of what the ultimate value is. But on a deep level, that does not need to express itself by removing any sense of value from anything else. As if to say that the only way to fully express how choshuv, the right thing is to equally fully express how non-choshuv everything else is. And the Arba Banel says, it doesn't work that way, because there are hierarchies here. There's a ladder, and Torah is at the top, there's no question about it, but there are many values that the Torah itself endorses, and they shouldn't suffer through the primacy of Torah. On the contrary, the more a person is rooted in the primacy of Torah, the more there is room to accord the appropriate respect to all of those things. And it's true for so many things. It brings to mind a comment of the Ksava Kabbalah in Parshas Lech Lecha, which I felt was room to add just a little PS to. The Arba Banel begins by alerting us to the fact that Avram, who's called Avram Ivri, as we know, is actually only called Avraham Ivri once in the entire Torah. It sounds like he called it the whole time, but he isn't. Only once. In Parshas Lech Lecha, when there's the war between the four kings and the five kings, and the Pasuk says, Vayavo ha-palit, the refugee comes, Vayaged la-Avram pa-Ivri. And he tells Avram the Ivri. So it's interesting, of all the times, not before, and never again in the Torah, Avram is referred to as the Ivri there. Why? Was he only an Ivri when the palit was talking to him? So the Ksava Kabbalah says, when the Torah makes a point of calling Avram an Ivri there, it's because the palit was addressing him as an Ivri. The palit was coming to talk to him as an Ivri. And what does that mean? See, when you think about it, this refugee from the war, he was coming to try and convince Avram to do something that no sane person would do. Namely, there's an enormous war in the region and I'd like you to rush headlong into it. Intuition says one should move in the opposite direction. So now the palit is saying, well, how am I going to activate Avram? How am I going to galvanize him? How am I going to get him to go into the war? Where every sense of self-preservation would say he should move away from the war. But I don't want him to move away from the war. I want him to get involved. How am I going to get him involved? The answer is the four kings who were dominating the five kings and spreading a reign of Avodah Zorah, as we know. Amraphel, Melech Shinar, that's Nimrod. Wherever they go, Avodah Zorah is spreading. So now the palit says, Avram, you have no choice. You're an Ivri. Your life is about combating Avodah Zorah, and their campaign is to spread it. You have to go to war. So he used the Ivri card with Avram. You can't say no. It's an offer you can't refuse. You have got to go to war. Very interesting. Ad kan, the words of the Ksava Kabbalah. And what's very interesting is, he doesn't pursue the matter, but if you look at the next pasuk, the pasuk says, Vayishma Avram ki nishba achiv. Avram heard that his nephew had been captured. Vayarek es chanichav. He's got his bachrim together, his tamidim, and off they went to war. So now, it seems to be a very difficult question on the Ksava Kabbalah. Because according to the Ksava Kabbalah, the palit is telling him they're spreading Avodah Zorah. But the very next pasuk says Avram heard something completely different. He heard that his nephew had been captured. So it really sounds like they're talking across purposes. The palit comes to Avram and says, Avram, Nimrod, he's conquering everywhere. He's spreading Avodah Zorah. And Avram says, what? My nephew has been captured? Okay, I've got to go to war. No one was speaking about that. How can that be the response? And I think that continuing the theme of the Ksava Kabbalah, this is exactly what Avraham Avinu means to communicate to the palit. Namely, he's made a mistake. The palit thinks that the only thing that will cause Avraham as a religious man to extend himself, to put himself out, is if it's an issue of Avodah Zorah. If it's paganism versus monotheism, I'm in. If it's family, don't bother me. That's clearly how the palit says, Avram, you're an Ivri. Your nephew's been captured, that probably doesn't bother you at all, but it's Avodah Zorah. It's a religious issue. And Avram responds and says, you've made a mistake. I am an Ivri. But because I'm an Ivri, I go to war for my nephew as well. Not just for Avodah Zorah, because he's family. He's my brother. He followed me, and I have a chriyas to him. And what a chiddush it was. No one else had thought that way. And for a long, long while, people would not yet come to think that way. This was the chiddush of Avraham Avinu. Being an Ivri, let me tell you what being an Ivri means. It means if my brother's in trouble, I also go to war for him. Because that's also a Torah-endorsed value. It's called family. And this is what the Abarbanel is saying at the end of Bamidbar. Bechor is also something. He doesn't have to suffer. He doesn't have to get trodden on just because the one carrying the Aron goes first. If he's come second, and he can't be first. But there's different ways to come second, and the second with recognition of being a Bechor. And there is a great deal to ponder in this idea of the Abarbanel, but it behooves us to have a deeper sense of appreciation of the Chashivos of Torah, because the more we appreciate the Torah in a deep sense, the more we will find space to grant ample respect to everything that the Torah itself respects, which is a great deal. We'll leave it over there for you.